Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor here on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg. This week, we're talking with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Thanks so much for being with us. Today's show is pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take more questions for the mayor. But as you're listening, remember you can always email your questions for any of our show's mayors to ask, that's A-S-K, at WBAA.org. Welcome to the show, Mayor Barton.
Thank you. It's good to be here as always.
Absolutely. So last month, we talked about attracting business to Crawfordsville, and it was announced that Temper Sealy will be coming to town. So first, tell us what we're talking about here. What are they constructing in the area?
Well, it's a very large facility, you know, that could be, I think initially starts out at like 700,000 square feet, but could be expanded up to 1 million square feet. About a $150 million investment on their part, initially about 300 jobs. So it's a significant project. And, you know, I mean, Temper Sealy is a global corporation and could have chosen to locate anywhere in the world, really, and we're just really excited that they have chosen Crawfordsville and Montgomery County.
And what will this particular Temper Sealy facility be doing? What do they make?
Right. This is on the Temper side, and if you look back through the company, you know, Temper and Sealy were two separate companies.
Okay.
Temper being more the foam mattress side, and this will be a facility that actually pours and manufactures the foam mattresses. So the higher end product, very specialized, patented process, and that'll take place here. This is adding capacity to their overall operation because they've just seen a real uptick in demand.
I had been reading, actually, that there was an uptick in mattress demand over the past year as people were kind of sorting through how to spend some of their income during the pandemic. That was interesting.
Yeah, you know, and they explained that, you know, what they do is directly related to home improvements and home sales and, you know, all the things that we saw really turn up during the pandemic. But they're projecting long-term growth and, we're looking to expand their capacity. And again, you know, they're in markets all over the world. So, you know, they have to be very strategic about where they locate their manufacturing because obviously shipping is a big part of you know, the cost when they send their product out the door. So being in the Midwest was very, very attractive to them.
And I guess how else were local leaders able to make the case that Montgomery County, that Crawfordsville was the place to put this plant? How did you make that pitch?
Well, you know, something like this starts out with a very large national search and then gets narrowed down. And for us, and first I'm going to point out that this project is in the unincorporated area, so Montgomery County had the lead on this. I was there in a supporting role.
Mm-hmm.
But from the start, you know, my point was we have to distinguish ourselves. We have to show them how we are different because I can't imagine looking, you know, at all these potential sites and the spreadsheets and trying to sort through, you know, and make a decision. It has to be daunting. So my goal is always to set us apart and show how we are different. And that's what we did. And, you know, that starts with, you know, on the county side, putting together an incentive package that was competitive. The state of Indiana and IEDC came to the table and helped create a very compelling, like I said, aggressive incentive package. You have to get utilities lined up. You have all those things. And then where I really became involved is really selling the community and selling quality of life and really our approach to doing business. That was kind of my wheelhouse and what I focused on. And we did set ourselves apart because what they saw, and they told us this, was, you know, that we very head-on acknowledged, look, here are some challenges our community's faced in the past, and here's how we have created solutions, and we solve these challenges, and then we move forward. And, you know, workforce is a challenge. No matter where they located, they were going to face workforce challenges, and our community is no different. But what they liked is that we are meeting as a group collectively, and we are identifying and creating locally driven solutions to address workforce. So, you know, we could give them some comfort that here is the plan if you choose to come to Montgomery County and Crawfordsville. Here is the plan and how we will be your partner in ensuring that you have an adequate workforce.
And we've been talking about, and this includes on last month's show, some of the issues happening right now around employment and attracting workers and open jobs on the market. And this is a concrete example of having to grapple with some of that.
It is. It is. And we are seeing some significant shifts in that labor market. But again, you have to go in and identify, you know, your weaknesses or what do you think is keeping people out of the job market. And for example, one very concrete thing we could point to is childcare. We identified that early on. We heard it loud and clear from our employers that the lack of childcare or quality childcare was keeping people out of the workforce. And so we've really been working hard on that. We created a task force. We've actually added childcare capacity in our community through a lot of partners coming together to make it happen. And so they saw that as, you know, somebody in our community that's really creating some solutions, and it's helping. I mean, they're, you know, we now have that capacity that someone who wants to enter the workforce at least has options. The next step is to make sure they're quality, they're on the path to quality, and that they're affordable, because, you know, it's easy to do the math and see that some people are kept out of the workforce because childcare can cost so much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a business model that's not easy to figure out. I mean, you know, childcare workers are not always paid real well because families can't afford to pay for childcare at a real high rate. So it's a tough thing to figure out.
So what is the time frame for this project?
Well, they hope to be, I mean, they're in the you know, design process right now, if you will. They hope to really break ground, you know, right around the first of the year. And that'll be earthwork and things like that. So there's still some steps that have to happen. There has to be a rezone of that property for this to occur. The Montgomery County Commissioners, that's now on their agenda for next Monday's meeting. So that'll be considered. It's been through the county's plan commission. So there's some things like that. There's some approvals that have to go through, like the County Redevelopment Commission, because there's infrastructure to put in place. There's water, there's sewer, there's roads, mm-hmm. things like those types of things. So all that has to take place over the next few months, and then hopefully we'll see dirt moving out there, you know, right around the first of the year.
So that's kind of the physical aspect of this. And then, and this might be an estimate, you know, how long does it take to staff up a facility of that type? I think you said this represents about 300 jobs.
Right. And you know, our understanding is it'll be a ramp up. It won't be, you know, all of a sudden we need 300 people. It'll be more of a gradual workup. And there'll be some people come with the company, but for the most part, it'll be regional hires from this part of the state. So, yeah, I mean, we're still looking a ways out. And we know that makes it tough right now because, you know, for example, you know, Greencastle to our south, one of their major employers has announced some pretty significant reductions, layoffs, permanent layoffs, job eliminations in auto part manufacturing. So we've reached out because that would be a perfect fit. We're pretty close. They could commute here and work. But they're not totally closed up yet, and these jobs aren't available yet. So you've got mm-hmm. some timing issues going on there. But we're confident that the starting wages that they're considering, we're confident that they'll find the workforce that they need here.
And this came up a bit last month, so I'll quickly ask too, you know, how does this impact other businesses in your area who are also looking for workers right now?
Yeah, and we hear from some of them. I mean, obviously there's a concern. You know, it will shift some things around. There's no doubt about that. But our theory is that, you know, it's kind of the rising tide and all ships coming up. Competition forces everybody to bring their better game. So we've had that discussion at our workforce roundtable, and I think our other employers are comfortable with that because they understand that even though it looks on the surface like this will make it a little more difficult for them, it also means that we'll have new residents moving into the community. So maybe one spouse is going to work at Temper Sealy, there's another, the trailing spouse coming along with them, or there, you know, there are other family members coming along. So this really starts, these kinds of things opens the door to really growing our community, growing our population, and increasing the workforce pool for all of our employers at all wage levels. So they understand that this is much part of a much bigger picture. You can't just look at this one announcement on the surface.
Can you talk a little bit, too, about how the arrival of something like this could help draw other corporations, other companies to your area?
Well, it is a factor, and it was interesting. One of the companies that we've attracted recently, their top leadership sent me a message a few days later and said, this gives us a really good feeling because it kind of validates what we saw in Crawfordsville. We took a risk and we announced we were coming there, and then this announcement came out. And this person who sent it to me said, I immediately went down the hall to the CEO and said, look at this. We were onto something here. This is significant. So they do look around and they do want to see that other companies are investing. I think where we'll see the big benefit is, in the potential spinoff in the retail and dining portions, things like that. When this was announced, I heard a few people say, well, we don't need more jobs. We need another grocery store. We need more restaurants. Well, this is exactly how you get those things. You don't get those things on them, standing alone. You need jobs, you need opportunities, you need more population growth to get there.
And I'm having a memory now. This is from a few years ago. We talked about telling the story of Crawfordsville. And I guess what's tell us the story. What story did you tell them? About we're talking about quality of life and what it's like to be in Crawfordsville. What was that sale?
Well, we make the point that we think we're an ideal combination of things. I mean, we're big enough to have the things that you want, but yet we're small enough to have that closeness and that small community feel. You can be to downtown Indianapolis in a matter of a few minutes. You can be to Indianapolis International Airport in a few minutes. You can be to Lafayette. You can be to all these other places pretty quickly and easily. And we really emphasized how this community works together collectively as a team. And I think that's kind of a rarity from what I see. A lot of communities are not able to do that. And we pointed to things like our mobile integrated health, which is solely based on the community coming together in teamwork. We talked about Workforce Roundtable. We talked about all the different things we've done collectively in this community and how all the partners are at the table. And they saw, in the presentations, the city and the county standing side by side in all of this. So that was really our big sales pitch, was that we are a community that comes together as a team, and we understand that concept. We support one another, and we create locally driven solutions, very big on innovative ideas. And that resonates. It does resonate with these companies. They don't want to come someplace where there's fighting and division.
You are listening to Ask the Mayor on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg, and we're talking right now with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. So, Mayor, going to shift a bit here. July 4th coming right up. So let's talk about fireworks.
Oh,
I
boy.
saw some back and forth on this question on social media. So it occurred to me, let's re-clarify. Crawfordsville now has an ordinance that stipulates fireworks are allowed during certain hours and days around, I believe, the 4th of July, New Year's, Chinese New Year. Residents are not allowed to set them off at other times. For example, right now, are people getting that? Are residents still setting off fireworks, maybe when they shouldn't be?
It seems to be going very well, and we know that the first year or two might be a little rough. And that ordinance, I talk about, the city council and everything being a citizen-driven process, and that's exactly what happened in that case. It had just gotten out of hand since, those types of fireworks were legalized by the legislature years ago, and now you have, you just pour a bunch of that in the community every year, and people would set them off for a month before, a month after, all day, all night, and citizens finally stood up and said, we've had enough. This is totally disrupting our peace. We want to celebrate. We love our independence, but enough is enough. And so the council passed this ordinance. So yeah, the first year we expect it to be a little bumpy, although it has been far less bumpy than what I thought it might be. Now, there are areas where we'll have people call and say, I am hearing fireworks. Again, this only applies in the city. So a lot of our neighborhoods are on the periphery, and the ordinance does not apply to those neighborhoods. So I know where I live, I hear fireworks quite a bit, but the area where they're shooting them off is not in the city. So, but it's a move in the right direction, and I think it will help calm things down for our residents.
I know that sometimes if I'm home and hearing the sound of fireworks, it's difficult to tell where it's coming from. You know, it can feel kind of like it's off in the distance somewhere. What would you advise, you know, a Crawfordsville resident who wants to make a call, isn't sure what to do? You know, what can they do about that if the fireworks are creating an issue for them?
If you're hearing something and you're concerned, I mean, you can always call the police department, and it's not a high priority call, but as they have the opportunity, they'll check it out and see what's going on. And we're really going to lean towards education this first year. I mean, the goal is not to go out there and start citing everybody, you know, who's lighting off some fireworks. The goal is really to educate people that there's a set time for this, and you need to stay in that time. Just place the call, and if it's an ongoing thing and you're having issues, by all means, feel free to call the mayor's office, and we'll assign somebody to try to figure out what's happening with it. But, last year seemed to be, it just came to a head, and I know all the fireworks vendors reported that they all sold out last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was the pandemic, you know, what was going on, but people... They bought all these fireworks and were just setting them off all the time, and residents were at wit's end over it. So we'll see. I think this will help, and we'll see what happens.
So last year, 4th of July celebrations everywhere were impacted by COVID. You know, they weren't as large, or they were just canceled altogether. What's happening in Crawfordsville this year?
Well, we did our fireworks last year. We just kept everybody spaced out. This year, we're going to do our fireworks again. We are going to continue to kind of scale back the Freedom Festival side of it. And
what does that entail, that side of it?
Well, in the past that was some food vendors and some activities for children. And you know, COVID aside, that's kind of been in transition the last few years anyway. So it is so hard in our case to really plan that and predict it, because it totally, totally depends on the weather, for one, obviously.
Right.
But it also depends on how the 4th falls. And what we've noticed, if the 4th falls during the week, we'll have a much larger crowd.
Why do you think that is?
If a 4th falls on the weekend, everybody leaves town. So,
okay,
yeah,
that makes sense.
They take off, they go, you know, they're off doing other things. So it's really kind of up and down and unpredictable, which has made it pretty tough to bring vendors in. So we're going to keep that really tight and small again this year. The 4th is on a Sunday. That presents some interesting dynamics to think about. But we'll have the fireworks that evening. We are going to keep those on the 4th. We know a lot of people are off on Monday. So we'll do those. We'll have a good time and respect the fact that, you know, not everybody enjoys those. Because we hear from residents who say, you know, please just keep it one evening on the 4th. We can predict it. We know what's going to happen, and then it's over. Because our dogs are on edge, or our animals are on edge, and so forth.
So the Strawberry Festival also returned this year, and I think that took place a few weeks back. How did that go?
It was great. The committee did a great job of returning things, but yet adapting and making some changes. And it had to be record crowds. And I've been around the festival now for close to 40 years. This was the best one that I've ever seen. And I think it was just that release. People wanted to be there. They were excited to be there. They wanted to get out and do something. The entertainment was fantastic this year. Crowds were fantastic. The weather, for the most part, was good. We had one little glitch on Saturday night. It rained on Elvis, but there's probably a song in there somewhere.
Rained on Elvis, yes.
Yeah, so, but, and the vendors, so, I mean, it was all really, really good and really, I would say, record turnout. So, but they made some changes. You know, they eliminated using tickets to buy food and the picnic table areas where people kind of congregated and things like that. And I think they were kind of looking at those changes anyway, but it was hard to make them. But this justified it, and it was a overwhelming success. So I look for some of those changes to kind of become permanent.
What else is on the roster this summer in Crawfordsville? I believe you have your iteration of the Ironman race coming up later on in August.
So there will be, there's several events out at the Ironman Raceway that will draw national and international crowds. Downtown we have, there's the Lunches on the Plaza. There's First Friday concerts sponsored by Main Street. There's Second Friday concerts sponsored by the Rotary Club and Hoosier Heartland Bank. So a lot of programming happening in the Pike Place and then in the downtown area. And they already had one of the First Friday concerts, and I I didn't get to go. I had a graduation. My youngest daughter was graduating, so I had to be there. But mm-hmm. I understand that it was a record crowd. And so I think that's a good sign also. So a lot of things like that happening. But, you know, of course, the stuff at the Ironman Raceway is huge because you just have so many thousands of people coming in. Then we get into fall and Wabash College will be back. And hopefully, you know, college football and those kinds of things.
So let's talk a little bit about COVID here. Indiana's COVID-19 metrics map has looked pretty different recently. Most of the state is now in the blue category, indicating the least serious level of spread. I wanted to ask, though, Montgomery County has gone back up to yellow, and the state did flag a large number of cases in congregate settings. I know that's impactful. Today, I just checked the seven-day positivity rate in the county is at 10.5%. Can you talk about what you're seeing and hearing? You know, what's happening here? What's accounting for this uptick?
Well, we're due for a briefing from the health officer coming up. So we're about a week out from it. But again, we're in the yellow solely, I think, from what I see, because of the positivity rate. And to me, that measurement is just so subjective. It's hard to really read much into that because it's not reflective of the positive rate within the community as a whole. It's reflective of the positive rate within the testing pool. And if you think about it, the more people who get vaccinated or who've had it, who are taken out of that testing pool in a sense, you know, you're only testing sick people or people who are symptomatic. You know, the percentage is positive, 1 in 10 basically, is going to go up. So the congregate setting piece is, I'm sure, a factor. We are not terribly concerned at this point, just because we know that it's a change within the testing pool. And one of the things that happened to us is that Wabash College was testing basically every student every week.
Okay.
So you have 800 tests thrown into the testing pool. That's, you know, and very few of those come back positive. So that's going to drive down your positivity rate. When you shut that off, now the testing pool is much, much more shallow, and you're testing people who are probably more symptomatic. And it's so hard to compare that from one county to the next. I'm quite frankly shocked they're still using that as a measurement tool, because every county has a little bit different approach to testing, and it's solely reflective of the pool.
So Governor Holcomb's sort of last extension of Indiana's public health emergency ends on June 30th, so next week. And then after that, something that will change is that Indiana's local school boards will have control over whether to mandate masks indoors. And more than one school corporation in your area has said they'll be lifting that mask mandate. And kind of the overall kind of a guiding principle right now is, okay, what are our modes of protection? If you don't get vaccinated, then you wear a mask. Those are kind of like the options. So how does all of this work specifically in the schools, you know, where aside from children who just might not be getting the COVID vaccine, there will still be some portion of unvaccinated children simply because they're still not eligible?
That's a tough one, you know, and I know two of the three school boards have come out and said we're not going to require masks,
mm-hmm.
You know, and you're right. So it's really easy for us to say in the general population, look, you know, if you are not vaccinated, you choose to not be vaccinated, then, you know, the parameters are different. It's a little different to do that with children because they're not necessarily the ones making that decision.
Mm-hmm.
The parents are making that decision for them. So I think, you know, I've read some really good stuff bringing up really good food for thought all the way around in that discussion, because it does create some very challenging dynamics. You know, if you're going to, you know, say, okay, if you're not vaccinated, you have to wear a mask. So all of a sudden this child gets singled out in a sense, right? And we don't need any more peer pressure and bullying in our schools. We don't need a way to single kids out anymore. So, school boards are going to have to make those decisions, and I'm sure the professionals will weigh in about all the different things that we're just not thinking about on the surface, you know, as you think about children in schools and singling kids out and treating different children differently. So a lot to think about there, that's for sure.
I know, and in terms of vaccinations, you and I have kind of touched on child vaccinations and how with COVID vaccinations, that outreach factor, again, kind of is for the parents, not necessarily for the child. But you've also talked about grappling with a gap in other vaccinations for children and how that issue has kind of been exacerbated by COVID. Have you had more conversations about how to come at both of those at the same time?
Well, it's very difficult to do both. We can't do both of them at the same time, I guess, is the correct answer. Because you can't give the COVID vaccine at the same time you're giving other vaccines. Mm-hmm. So we had to make some decisions, and I shouldn't say we, I wasn't involved in those, but I know the health officer and our community paramedic program made some decisions with different age groups to target different things. So those who were not old enough for the COVID vaccine, they were targeting those childhood immunizations, and we just approved an agreement at Border Works this morning, another award for additional funding for our childhood vaccination program. So it's up and running and doing great things, trying to catch these children up. And then the older ones, then you have to make a decision, do we focus on the COVID or do we focus on the childhood? Because you can't do both simultaneously. And I think in those cases, they're focusing on the COVID vaccine first and then trying to catch up the childhood. But I mean, the problem was made much, much worse because children couldn't go to the doctor. They couldn't go in for their well child checkups. They couldn't get, keep their immunizations up. We were already lagging, and it just made it much, much worse with the shutdown that occurred.
I guess something I've also been thinking about is, in what ways, say, health departments specifically everywhere are kind of having to look at where they might have to play some catch up since COVID was so consuming for them. Are you and how are you seeing some of that play out in your area?
Oh, there is a catch up. There's no doubt. And I think it'll probably be years before we really understand all the impacts, everything that happened. I mean, I read stuff now where, oncologists are saying, look, we're going to see an impact from this for many years because cancer screenings basically weren't happening for a year, things like that. So we're hearing that from our partners at the Indiana State Department of Health. And again, we're really concentrated on that vaccine side because that's where we can make a difference. But we've seen it with substance abuse as well. I mean, we were well ahead of, really on our way to creating some impactful programs here to really help people suffering with opioid addiction and substance abuse. And we're still working on it, but it was definitely set back during the pandemic, and addictions got worse. That problem worsened at the same time we weren't able to help like we had been helping before. So we will be measuring the impacts of this for many, many years to come.
I also just saw Crawfordsville's Board of Works approved an agreement for Franciscan Physician Network to have medical supervision over the fire department's paramedicine program. And then they'll in turn have access to Franciscan facilities and equipment. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's something that had already been in place. We had been doing for a while, and the agreement was, and this is splitting legal hairs, but the existing agreement was with one entity, and we had to change it to the Physicians Network. So it was just kind of a name change is what was happening there. But that's a great partnership and works very, very well for everyone.
Okay, that's our time for today. Mayor Barton, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You can find this program at our website, WBAA.org, along with an archive of our shows with the mayors of Lafayette, West Lafayette, Crawfordsville, and Frankfort. Send us your questions to ask@WBAA.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great rest of the day.